What Byzantinism is this in Istanbul? Byzantium in popular culture.
So welcome everyone. This is Emir Alışık, organizer of this podcast series. We are here today for an episode of What Byzantinism is This in Istanbul, organized by the Istanbul Research Institute. In each episode, we invite researchers and artists to discuss the Byzantium-related inspirations of a particular artistic production. This show is made by the enthusiasm of the many contributors of the exhibition What Byzantinism is This in Istanbul, Byzantium in Popular Culture, that is taking place between the 23rd of November and the 6th of March in the Pera Museum, Istanbul. Today, we are together with the acclaimed novelist and editor, a pioneer of the new weird, Jeff Vandermeer. Among others and many nominations, he is a recipient of Nebula, Shirley Jackson, and World Fantasy Awards, both as a fiction writer and as co-editor with Anne Vandermeer of tomes such as The Weird, New Weird, Big Book of Classical Fantasy, and Big Book of Modern Fantasy. The last one features one story from the acclaimed Turkish author Bilge Karasu too. His awards-winning novel Annihilation was adapted into a movie in 2018 by the director Alex Garland. His fiction has been the topic of numerous academic research articles and books by respected academic publishers. I'm now happy to add Pera Museum books among these. His most recent novel is Hummingbird Salamander. But today we will talk with Jeff mostly on his earlier fiction, specifically Ambergris Cycle, which consists of City of Saints and Madmen, Shriek and Afterword, and Finch. The cycle is re-released in a single volume by the MCD Books last year. Jeff, it's thrilling to have you here to talk about Ambergris and Byzantium. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. I'm so thrilled to be part of this.
Thank you. So if you are ready, so we can start with some questions, right? Okay, so here's my first question for you. Maybe we should break the ice for the audience and initiate them to the world of Ambergris. So can you tell a bit about the plot and narrative construction of Ambergris Cycle, and especially of City of Saints and Madmen for the listeners who are not?
I think it's one of those things where, you know, for one reason that Ambergris came into being was that I grew up overseas, not in the U.S., and visited a lot of countries, but was never really didn't feel part of them. And so I think I tried to reconcile those experiences by creating an imaginary place where some of my memories could be the influence on the fiction without being appropriative. Because even in Fiji, where I lived for a long time, or a fair amount of time, I was still somebody on the outside looking in. So there's that. And then basically the city itself is perhaps most hilariously a fantasy city in which there is no real fantastical element. Everything has some kind of rational explanation, even if it's a very strange one. And what it boils down to is the city that's kind of carved out by taking it away from the original inhabitants by these whalers who then, you know, create this city called Ambergris, and the repercussions historically of not having reconciled how the city was founded kind of reverberate out. So you have a mass disappearance that factors in. You have these underground inhabitants who also have their own agency and agenda. And the whole series plays out across more than 100 years of history, and historical theory and a wider canvas is very important, even though there are these intimate stories told of various characters. And City of Saints and Madmen in particular is made up of different stories and novellas that form a kind of mosaic that has a completion to it, because there are minor characters from one that are major in another. And the reader comes to view certain historical events and certain characters in a different way by the end of the volume. And in addition to the Byzantine history, there is certainly a huge amount of French decadent fiction influence and things like that going on in the series.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So since you mentioned Venetian history and Byzantine history, so maybe we can go into more a little bit to these Byzantine aspects of the novel. So let me just briefly paraphrase one of our contributors to the exhibition catalog ideas on a new kind of Byzantinism. So Roland Betancourt conceptualizes a paratextual Byzantinism, which foregoes Byzantine iconography but emulates a Byzantine aesthetic. So the Byzantine elements in your novel, and also the Venetian elements, I would say, are very subtle and might be hard to identify. So can you tell us about how you utilized history in your writing? And maybe you can give some examples of the specific references to Byzantine history.
Well, I think there's obviously the striking iconography, religious iconography, that informs the kind of wealth of different faiths and aspects of different faiths in the religious quarter in the city, which is definitely visually influenced by that. There would also be the fact that as I started to look into, I was also reading a ton of history books about the Byzantine period and Byzantium. And one thing that I was struck by is how, as the Byzantine military power kind of faded, the diplomatic power and the shifting of alliances became extremely complex. And so I thought it would be really interesting, in as much as there's conscious thought in fiction as opposed to what comes out of your subconscious, to create a city that reflected that, that reflected what happens when you're not a strong military power and you have to negotiate all these things and your survival depends on trade and a lot of influences coming to bear that may be in conflict but have to be kind of managed, and I found that to be really one of the most interesting things was the late period Byzantine history and how skillful these kinds of negotiations and whatnot had to be in order for the state, so to speak, to survive. And that suggested fiction. That suggested a great deal of complexity and unique qualities in fiction. A lot of the individual details that I found and things like John Julius Norwich's trilogy of books were fascinating to me. They were little details sometimes, but little details can play a large role in fiction. And so there were details of Byzantine culture. There were details about different factions of playwrights, for example, and armed conflict coming out of that that get transferred into the Ambergris books. Which I think is fascinating because it's more unique than just a normal kind of coup or military struggle. The idea of different theater factions coming into conflict led to there being rival publishing houses in Ambergris, which is a huge thing. And almost all that detail comes from Byzantine history and from the aspects of history that don't seem like they could be real, but they are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what is striking for me is that when Byzantine history is a topic of fiction, it is mostly the times when the empire is at its best, let's say, or the empire when it is at the end, namely 1453. So you really took a time when it was in crisis and some other things other than military were flourishing. So it's really interesting to witness this, actually. So you mentioned John Julius Norwich as one of the inspirations, one of your research area for this novel. But my next question was about your research on this novel, on Byzantine history related research. But maybe since you mentioned Julius John Norwich, you can tell us what you omitted were researching, what you didn't want to include.
Right. Well, I was drawn to Norwich. I do not know how he ranks in terms of Byzantine historians. What attracted me to him was that he knows how to tell a good central story and then hang really interesting details off of it. Now, I know enough that when you can't take any historical narrative that you read in a book as the full story. So you have to cross, you have to triangulate that. But what I also found interesting is that he was attempting to kind of redeem a period of history, in part that Gibbons had typified as a descent into barbarism. And I found that pretty fascinating, the revisionist, you know, idea that Gibbons was really wrong about all this stuff. And that tension there also creates something interesting in the novel because of how Ambergris is perceived by the outside world. It even suggests, the situation at the end of Byzantium, where you have another strong kind of civilization come in and add their own influence. Because in the Ambergris books, there's always this far off caliph that is the more advanced, sophisticated society in Ambergris. It's kind of the backwater, and that's kind of also talking about Byzantine history in a positive way. And kind of reversing what you sometimes see, unfortunately, in U.S. and European and UK fantasy novels, which is the farther east you go, the worse things seem. So I definitely wanted to reverse that, which I think is also a fairly problematic trope. But Norwich, you know, led me then to a lot of not books, but things I can't even really necessarily conjure up now, because I would be looking at his source material, or I'd be looking at individual articles to kind of cross triangulate. And also, as a fiction writer, you're sometimes, you know, there's me knowing that there's a fact that maybe, you know, is inviolate, but I'm also looking for the eccentricities in historians and their accounts, and even the mistakes they make as things that suggest fiction. So it's not like I'm trying to research for a nonfiction book. And so therefore I don't need to always read a text that is completely factual, so long as I, as the writer, know that what I'm responding to is not factual.
Okay. So great take, really. Okay. So I'll continue with some in-depth, let's say, questions towards the novels. So in Shriek and Afterward, there's a statement that, and we put this statement in the exhibition too. Mm. So it says, I think it was Janice Shriek who says that, at the heart of the city lies not a courtyard or a building or a statue, but an event. But in the city of Ambergris, there are many physical landmarks that transform through ages. So what is the role of those landmarks? How do they work with that event, this infamous festival, and the silence?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one thing that occurs to me in terms of landmarks is simply what it means that Voss Bender's visage is on statues everywhere, or that certain events are memorialized and set in stone in such a way that they suggest that there's only one way of reading things. I think what I love about the way that Norwich and others have to work on the earliest parts of their books is they have fewer and fewer source materials that can be relied upon. So they have to themselves build a picture from fragments, right? And the farther back you go in history, maybe beyond, you know, well before the Byzantine era, that becomes more and more the case, where you have fragments that you are putting things together in almost an archaeological way. So part of what that means, I think, is that Ambergris is built as a city through the differing points of view of its citizens, interpreting different events like the silence and using them for either their political ends or societal reasons. They're interpreting them in a certain way. And the reader only gets the truth by sifting through the various opinions about the facts that the different characters have. And they may contradict each other wildly, because what's really happening is through the physical manifestations in the city, you're seeing various factions struggling for control of kind of the group imagination of the city. You know, what do these things mean? And I think that anytime you have a unresolved trauma at the heart of a culture for, in this case, a city-state, that's what happens. These things accrete around it like the scars around a wound. And so that's really what happens, is the city is never resolved as one thing, because they never resolved the initial violence at the creation of the start. If that makes any sense. I may be a little bit farther off from your question than you meant.
No, actually, I would like to say, in the Finch, where chronologically we are really in the future, let's say, so the inhabitants somehow lost many of the memories regarding the city, like this, even the silence itself, if I remember correctly. So, but the landmarks mostly are present, even though the city became a very fractured thing at that point. But the landmarks' meanings also transformed. So, I mean, that echoes very well as with what you said, that when we go back further, we lose some aspects of the history, right?
And I think it manifests most directly in Finch because of that time leap. So you have, for example, a building that was the major Hogue Boatman and Sons traders headquarters, and is now a kind of police station, but for occupiers to, basically control the populace. And I think that is another example of how we reimagine spaces. And that's something that at that time of writing Finch was something I was obsessed with, is just the functionality and design of spaces and how we design things, how that affects how we feel within them, but also, whether it kind of reinforces authority or it reinforces an idea of freedom, just by the building itself and how it may be, in this case, repurposed. And so there's a lot in Finch where, it's interesting because in Finch, in a way, the Byzantine underpinnings of some of those buildings are being repurposed as if they're, that they're no longer that, they are something else entirely.
Yes,
but there's still underneath that, that's an underlying layer to them that also can't, that doesn't go away.
I mean, it's a very similar layering, very, very
interesting and potentially kind of poignant without being nostalgic.
Yeah, it's a very familiar experience for Istanbul, let's say. So. Since many of the present buildings changed meanings and changed many times those meanings and still changing, it's very
and that is something that I had to research because it's not something that you see as prominently in the U.S., especially like where I live. What you're more likely to see is the demolition of something and the construction of something else. Rather than the transformation of something, and that's because we don't have a building from the Middle Ages that took a century to build that you can't really demolish. I think of Romania and how after the fall of the dictator there, how they repurposed his palace as the site of the legislature because there was just no way, they wanted to just get rid of it, but they couldn't. And so now it's the legislature in the front. And last I saw in the back, the marble is all cracked and there's a forest growing out the back, So those kinds of things fascinate.
Yeah. They are too valuable to destroy.
Right. And then just too expensive. Permanently.
True. So you actually touched upon this issue of using of tropes and reverting the trope of, the idea that when you go further in the East, things get worse. So, but my question is related to that aspect. But if you have some more to say on that, please do. So for hundreds of years in various languages, Byzantinism have prerogative meanings stretching from decadence of art to effeminacy. from despotism to frivolous intricacy, especially in politics and theology. So we see many examples of such usage in the exhibition too. What is your take on reproducing or countering these meanings in fiction, other than you, what you have already said?
Right. Well, I think first of all, it is important to recognize that in terms of thinking about fantasy fiction in the UK and the US, that it has been very white and very Western European centered, and until recently, and so along with that is, I think, writers imported cliches or stereotypes or just the stuff that they remember from being taught in grade school without examining it. And yet the job of the writer is to, I think, interrogate everything, the foundation of everything, and ensure that the blind spots that you have or the non-truths are kept to a minimum. And so, you know, as soon as I started writing the first Ambergris story, there's the subconscious impulse that led to this novella about this missionary looking up in a window. But then there was also my own experience, for example, of growing up in Fiji and thus knowing exactly how negative the missionary impulse manifests often, right? So I mentioned that because that was kind of like the moment where things could have gone wrong in the series if I hadn't interrogated that moment. So by the time I was widening it to the Byzantine history and the other influences, I was already in this kind of high alert of what is the non-truth here? And again, no matter what, again, I don't know how Norwich ranks in terms of Byzantine historians, but the one thing he did convey very forcefully is the fact that there have been all these untruths about that period and that culture and society. And then I also had the examples, without naming names around me, of what I would say are somewhat romanticized views of Byzantium, as like this far distant Xanadu too, which I think is also an issue. You know, if you know what I'm saying, it's like this exotic quote unquote mm-hmm. place, and that may sometimes be a positive, but it's still a reducing down the complexities of all of it, right? So I wanted to dive into all the complexities and forge something out of those. But I would agree that, you know, the other thing is that can happen is that especially in things like epic fantasy, which is really not what Ambergris is, there are great examples of epic fantasy, but it can, in reducing it down to good versus evil, make it much harder to have any kind of complexity of morality or what you're talking about. So then if someone in that context refers to like a Byzantium type civilization, that is very hard for the level of granularity to deal with, let alone all the other issues that I mentioned. So those are kind of my thoughts about it. It's just that you always have to be pushing back. And if I was going to be dealing with the grand sweep of history, then I needed to be aware of that.
I mean, it turned out that you really managed not to romanticize any Byzantine aspects, because it is hard to detect even the Byzantine aspects of in the novel. So,
well, that is the other thing, is that there are two things going on. The first is that you have to transform the stuff. The other thing I didn't like is I would read stuff where it was thinly disguised, and I don't actually like reading a writer's research in a novel if it just takes up pages of description. So you have to kind of synthesize and get to a point where you've internalized enough of it that when it comes out, it's differently manifested. And those ways may be strange for some who know that history, because also Ambergris is supposed to be just a fractured reality that's kind of adjacent to ours. You know, like Manzikert comes out in a way as a word that I believe was a battle place, yeah, but it's actually a name of a lineage of kings in the novel. So for me, that worked as a way, again, of like changing the material. But for a historian, it seemed very strange. I don't know.
So. Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense, especially in the Finch. So I suggest people to read until the very end. So, yeah. So maybe now we can come to more tangible aspects of hamburgers by mentioning Scott Eagle.
Oh, yeah.
So as you know, we reproduced Scott Eagle's artwork for the cover of the City of Saints and Mad Men, I believe 2002 or 2002 edition, Prime Books edition. So can you describe your collaboration with him? How did the painting come to life? And maybe if you are up to it, you can tell us about a little bit about this, you know, a very intricate story of this City of Saints and Mad Men being into a published book and getting into a published book.
Sure. Well, first with Scott, he had submitted work to my wife, Anne, who was running a magazine that did art and surreal fiction. And so I discovered his art through her magazine. And we got to talking, and we had very similar sensibility as to how we even create art, different, you know, in different media, obviously, me in fiction and him in paintings and whatnot. And so I felt very comfortable with him from the very start. And when it came time to have input on the cover for the first edition of City of Saints, I really felt strongly that he would be a good choice for it. In part also because he had this training where he started out forging, you know, not forging to sell, but just forging the work of old masters and Bruegel and people like that. So he had some knowledge of art history and kind of a approach to it that was both modern and old, which I liked, which made sense for the layering of ambergris. And then I don't know how he tells the story because it's hard to remember exactly, but my memory is just that he said he was going to collage part of it using the work of old masters and then paint over it so that the light would be consistent across the collage, which, you know, I just thought that was genius. But we also talked about the iconography of the city. And at that point, we were kind of talking about the iconography in part of like Eastern Orthodox saints and whatnot. And so the painted part to me is kind of like a synthesis of that discussion with his inspiration from, for example, the transformation of Martin Lake, where there is a hand with an eye in it, in a dream. So that's how that came about. And I would say that since we've collaborated in so many different ways, that was the spark for our artistic and creative relationship that has continued up until, well, this very year, when there's a new edition of Ambergris, a limited edition with his art on it as well. So that's been great. In terms of the other question, I can't now remember the other question. The publication history.
I mean, the publication history, I mean,
Turkish agents,
maybe. We can read it in your blog still, right? Uh-huh. We'll put the link also for the curious.
Yeah, but I can briefly please talk about it. And keep in mind, of course, that there are two rival publishers in the imaginary city of Ambergris that are huge political factions. So all of the stuff that led up to the publication of City of Saints, in some ways also because I had time to add additional material, is hidden in parts of the appendix of the extended version of City of Saints. But basically, I wrote this novella, Drayden in Love, and couldn't find a place for it. And eventually, and this was before Anne and I were married and in a relationship, her publishing house actually published Drayden in Love using a Florida individual artist grant. And so that was an individual book. But then when I wrote more novellas, the same publications that were fine with the publishing short stories just weren't on board with these long, longer pieces that were more kind of history bound and surreal. So eventually I put it together in book form and I sent it around to all the major publishers and they all rejected it because they did not buy my assertion that it was a mosaic novel. They thought it was a story collection and they didn't want to buy a story collection, which notoriously don't sell as well, from a writer that wasn't as well known at the time. So then I started sending it around small presses and just to give you an idea in quick succession, I had a publisher in the UK buy it, but then this is so strange that the editor the editor basically became a Christian fundamentalist and he wanted me to change the characters so that they were more like characters in the Bible, which of course made no sense given the various influences on City of Saints. I had another publisher tell me that they would publish it, but they wanted me to change the location to Paris around 1900, so it was like a decadent era thing, and take out the underground mushroom dweller people. Someone who was an artist but also ran a publishing house bought it, but then they wanted me to change the text to fit their art because they had done art that deviated from the stories, oddly enough, and so I had to withdraw it. And then finally, I thought I had found a publisher in the UK. They wanted a limited edition as well. I collected $5,000 from friends and family, sent it to him, heard nothing for 6 months. I then heard from him that he was in an insane asylum and that he had spent all, he told me he was on his honeymoon and he had spent all the money from City of Saints to publish it on his wedding and his honeymoon. But I found out later he was actually in the sanitarium having had a nervous breakdown because he had built so many people out of money in his publishing company that he couldn't handle the stress anymore. And during this time, I started getting emails from his lawyer, who was actually him under another Hotmail account, trying to warn me off getting the money back. So I eventually got most of the money back. And eventually after that, Michael Moorcock, who is also known for some of his Byzantium work, was kind enough to write an introduction, get me an agent, saw the value in the material, and eventually kind of got me a small press publisher. And from there, it got much easier, but there was for a while a time when I was very scarred. And if you look at the extended version of City of Saints, there's a Mr. S who's listed, not in a good way, who is actually the publisher who stole all the money.
I mean, the last
ambergris forever.
The last publisher, the honeymoon one, I mean, he's like a person from the novel itself, right?
So. Yes, exactly. So, of course, I had to place him where he belonged.
yeah, true. Okay, I'll jump to the next question now. So elsewhere, you stated your desire to create a comic taking place after Finch. So is there any progress on that front? And since you mentioned that you discussed the iconography of Ambergris with Scott Eagle, so how would you like Ambergris to be visualized stylistically in such a comic, if it will come out eventually? And what else do you have in mind for Ambergris?
Well, I do think that certain aspects of the skyline of Istanbul would definitely come into play as an influence, and obviously there would be a lot of different things there, but obviously I don't know it depends so much on who the actual artist is, because you want to go with what their strengths are. But I do imagine something like Scott Eagle's art, but perhaps with a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit more variety of architectural influence than it's in City of Saints. But the idea I had for Finch 20 years after was simply that after the events in Finch, there is definitely some revolution without giving away plot points, but there's also what you might call stasis, which is to say various factions become stronger because of what happens at the end. But the city is still split between these factions. And I thought this would be very interesting to explore in a different context 20 years later with Finch as a very minor character. But I also saw there being many characters because I wanted to explore the political factions in interesting ways. And I didn't see a way in a novel to have, I don't know, 8 to 10 viewpoint characters. I usually find those kinds of novels very irritating. So a comic was like a stopgap, which is to say you could also do a TV series, but the comic kind of storyboards it out and also gives me more control over, you know, what would result. And I can do a comic script. I don't have the talent for some reason doing a movie or a TV script. So that was the idea, is that it was conceptualized as something that would have more of a omniscient viewpoint across different characters, and that the comic format would allow that that kind of like the right transitions too, between these different things. You might actually have a scene that's like hovering over the city, and you're like looking down in a building where someone's having a heated meeting, a political discussion, and then you move on to like something on the other side. You know what I'm saying? Like you can't really do that as well in a novel. So there's not been much progress on that, but in part that's because there's been interest in Finch as a TV series, although nothing is definite yet. So so that might take form in that way. And Ambergris in general, there is another piece called The Zamelon File that's in the limited edition, which is about an ill-fated expedition out of Ambergris to this place called Zamelon, where these monks live, and it's referenced in Finch a bit as kind of a pivotal place. But I never finished that. And I think a lot of that got cannibalized into Shriek and Finch. Okay. So I think that might be it. The main thing is that I think that the period after Finch, there's something really interesting there, but it has to be in a different medium.
Okay, so we are really waiting, looking forward to it. I mean, at least I am, definitely. So my last question is a classical one, actually. So what do you currently work on, and what can we expect to read from you in the near future?
You know, something like Annihilation, which I wrote in 2014, was an interesting inversion of the Ambergris process, because the Ambergris process did involve a lot of research into history and the place. Annihilation, it was just simply the place that I had hiked for years and years, and that was the setting. So the emphasis was very different in the novel, and the way it came out was very different. And what I had to focus on and what I had to just relax into was very different. And I'm currently working on a novel called The Stone Shed, which is set in kind of a transformed version of the ravine behind my house. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of thing as with Annihilation. I know the place so well after 4 years or so that I'm just kind of relaxing into the setting. And so it's a very different style than some of my other work. I'm also working on the sequel to A Peculiar Peril, which is billed as a YA fantasy, but is kind of a fantasy misadventure that's really as much for adults. There's a lot of things in it that I don't think kids will really get. There's a lot of allusions in the same way that there are allusions in City of Faith. In fact, it's probably weirdly the antic, humorous version of that style in City of Saints. Okay. And so I'm working on the sequel, which is largely set in Prague, a Prague on another earth, with in part Istanbul-based Islamic Republic that is the, again, like the Caliph in the City of Saints, is the rational, you know, sophisticated one, while the rest of Europe is kind of like a shambling backwater full of idiots. But anyway, so including the disembodied head of Napoleon helping Aleister Crowley, who is half moth, try to conquer Europe. But anyway, so oddly enough, this is allowing me to bring back in some of the history that I studied.
The most fun part.
Although in a very different context. So those are the two things I'm working on right now.
So are you going to visit Istanbul for research purposes in the near future?
I would very much like to. I mean, obviously the last 2 years has put a real damper on any kind of travel, but we're slowly learning how to travel again. So I would very, very much like to. I think there's sometimes an interesting value in distance to kind of translate something. Like if I had been writing directly about Istanbul, I would have definitely visited Istanbul before doing any kind of such writing. But because I was doing a fantasy city, there may have been something valuable in not visiting it. I know that may sound strange, but now that all that is done, so to speak, it'd be really fascinating to visit and to see what that led to, because most of my fiction is very much about place and about having some kind of tactile connection to a real place, no matter how fantastical the results are.
Yeah, if you do, Istanbul Research Institute has a fascinating library.
Oh, for research. That would be the first stop. Yeah. Yeah. I might not even go to the hotel first. I might go rent.
True. Yeah. So, Jeff, thank you for joining us today. I mean, it was such an amazing conversation for me and very illuminating for an Amberges fan, let's say. So, if you don't want to add anything, I'll just, yeah.
Well, I would just like to say again, it's such a pleasure speaking to you and being part of this, and I can't wait to see the book that's attached to the exhibit. I just can't wait at all. It's very nice to have a chance to chat, although it would be nice also to just talk about other things entirely if we ever get a chance to meet in person. So it'd be great.
Yeah, hopefully, let's say. Thank you. So thank you for joining us. We are ending another episode of What Byzantinism Is This in Istanbul. And Jeff van der Meer was with us talking about Amberges cycle. So good day, everyone.
What Byzantinism Is This in Istanbul? Byzantium in Popular Culture.